Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Joshua Pollack. Joshua Pollack is the best-selling author of The Heartfulness Way. He is a heartfulness practitioner and trainer from the United States. An accomplished Western classical violinist, he has performed and taught throughout the world, including numerous collaborations with composer A.R. Rahman of the Slumdog Millionaire fame. Pollack has appeared on All India Radio, Times of India, The Hindu, and New Indian Express. His columns have been published in Daily O and First Post. Pollack holds a Bachelor of Musical Arts degree from Indiana University and two master's degrees from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in London. He currently resides in India with his wife and two children. Mr. Pollack?
Hi. Thank you. So welcome to you all. You know, I want to start by telling my own story. It's not a dramatic story, not so exciting, but it's true. So my interest in meditation is something I can't quite pinpoint, but I do remember as a child being entranced by so many books on the subject. I'm from the state of Maine. You have to understand that in down east Maine, there's not a lot to do, right? Especially if you're from where I'm from. It's the middle of the woods, a small town of about 200 people in the winter, about 400 people in the summer. Okay? And my parents had a book collection. It's enormous. They still have it. And it's in no order at all. So it's kind of like one of these mystery things. You just, okay, you pick out a book, and what's this one about? You know, it's not organized into any kind of sections. So this was, you know, the kind of excitement that I had as a kid, you know? And whenever I came across something that was in this particular vein where it would be about, let's say, Buddhism or, you know, I remember coming across a lot of philosophy, Emerson, and books about Taoism. You know, these types of things entranced me a lot when I was young. And I would read them. I would just devour this kind of literature. But after a while, it started to frustrate me. Originally, it inspired me, but then it started to frustrate me because I would read about so many sort of enlightened states of being or, you know, refined states of consciousness, but reading about it didn't produce any of those effects in me. So simply reading about it, then I could only say, well, that's great for you, you know? And so this sort of, I became aware of this gap between where I was and what, you know, the possibilities which are being promised in these books. Now, one thing that so many of them had in common was that they would speak about meditation. So I realized that perhaps a practical approach is necessary. And I understood meditation to be a practical approach, not just knowledge, not just philosophy, not just belief, but practice. And through practice, that perhaps there was the promise of some kind of transformation, some kind of experience. So when I was about 19, and I'd moved away from Maine, I was in Boston. You know, and there I was, and all of a sudden I had access to various things. So I could try different kinds of meditation, and I could learn things. But even then, I still ended up frustrated. Perhaps maybe this frustration is part of my nature. But then again, you know, I would meditate with high expectations. But I found it difficult, and I thought maybe I'm not even cut out for such a thing. So after trying maybe 15, 16 different approaches, I kind of said, okay, maybe it's not for me after all. And this was, you know, I stayed in that frame of mind until one day I was just walking down the street, now in Cleveland, Ohio, and I was going to this little grocery store, and then I just bumped into somebody, a stranger, who I didn't know, but we got in a chat, we started having a conversation, and it turned out that they meditated. So I said, what kind of meditation is this? And they, well, it was this, what I now practice, this heartfulness meditation. And I'd never heard of it, and in fact, I was skeptical of it. But after a few months, I thought, why not? And you see, my young sister had passed away at that point. She was only 16, and she got in a car crash, and she died. Now, those times are actually when a lot of people search for something. You know, now I'm a meditation trainer, and so many times when people come to me, there's some personal tragedy in their life, which has prompted them to do a bit of seeking, to try to find some meaning. But for me, I had already done that, and it kind of came up empty. So I wasn't really sure what to do. So this meeting with that stranger on the street happened within 1 week, actually, of my sister's death. So eventually, I said, let me try this. And I did try it. And this time, I didn't have any expectation at all, because I'd had so many experiences which had left me a little bit disillusioned. And when I actually tried it, I think it was like I was like a beggar who had asked for a scrap of bread, you know, and been surprised by a banquet instead. This was my experience. The change that I was looking for in meditation through all those years was something that I kind of found in like 30 minutes. My first meditation. This is something I didn't expect. So my attitude now was, if such a thing can happen on my first day, well, what's tomorrow going to bring, you know? What's next week going to bring? So now I was inspired by what I'd experienced. And I'm still inspired, because it continues to change. It's now been 15, 16 years. And I'm still wondering what'll happen tomorrow. Now, somewhere along the way, I became a trainer as well. And, you know, in fact, this kind of meditation, it's been around for a little while. In fact, it's based on something called Raja Yoga, which is a tradition which is very old. You know, we're talking millennia now. And there is a lineage of guides in this tradition, a lineage of teachers. And when I first started, the teacher in this tradition was one man who I knew a little bit. But there was somebody else who I became friends with. His name was Kamlesh Patel. And I got to know him really because his son and I were the same age. We became neighbors. I moved to India at some point, which is another story. Right? And there we became neighbors, and I often hung out with his son, and I went to his apartment. And I just naturally, you know, I just naturally went to this man, Kamlesh Patel, whenever I needed any kind of advice. He always had it, you know. And he was such a grounded person, and I just trusted this person implicitly. And then a few years later, he kind of took me by surprise by being named the successor in this lineage of spiritual teachers, in this Raja Yoga tradition. And then, you know, when his predecessor passed away, he assumed this role. And shortly afterwards, he called me up and he said, Josh, I'd like you to write a book about meditation. And I said, sure, why not? Okay. And then I started having some doubts. Because when he's there, I thought, he's meditating for 40 years, he's a guide in this tradition. When he's there, why am I writing a book about meditation? It seemed absurd. So I went to him a few weeks later. I went to him and I expressed my trepidation on the matter. And he said, don't worry, it's okay. Let's talk about what should go in this book. So we started talking. And I kept asking him questions. And he kept responding to those questions. Which is unusual because he's not much of a talker, actually. But in this case, we had quite a dynamic dialogue. And what ended up happening in the end was that this dialogue became the book. So now it has become a book of dialogues between a teacher and a student about meditation, about spirituality, about yoga. And I suppose in a very accidental way, it fulfills this sort of ancient oral tradition where we see so many of these ancient Indian texts. It's always like this, actually, teacher-student dialogue going back and forth. So we didn't really intend it to happen like this, but that's the way it turned out. And we spent 2 years meeting in various places. You know, he's kind of an unusual person in terms of he doesn't fit the mold of the spiritual teacher or the guru or things like that, because, in fact, he spent 30 years in Staten Island running a pharmacy business, right? Raised 2 kids, you know? So a very grounded individual. But at the same time, living the spiritual life with absolute dedication. And so sometimes I met him at his family home in Staten Island, sometimes in Chennai, India, where I was based at the time, in Hyderabad, in Detroit, all over the place. We kept on meeting, in the Himalayas even. And finally now the book is out, The Heartfulness Way. Now, this book is about meditation, primarily. Its aim is to demystify meditation, because there's so much romance and so much mysticism associated with it. And in fact, it's a simple thing. And it's been said that the spiritual goal is a simple thing, in fact. And in order to, you know, attain something simple, in order to attain a state of simplicity, you have to use simple means. You can't use a crane to pick up a needle. So the idea was that this book shouldn't confuse people. It shouldn't prescribe complex methods to achieve a simple thing. So its aim is to demystify. Now, why meditate? It's the first question I ask in the book. And first he just said, why not? Okay, fine, why not? But why? And this is an interesting question, because if you ask, I think I see people in this room who are meditators already. And if you ask each one of them why they meditate, I'm sure the answer will be different. Because everybody has a unique makeup. Everyone has their own individual aim in meditation. I see this a lot as a trainer. People come, they want different things. Somebody wants to de-stress themselves. A lot of people want to de-stress themselves. Some people, I want peace of mind. Some people want to focus better. Some people are sleeping, they want to sleep better, right? Some people, their aims are, they say they're purely spiritual. They want to achieve God realization. Some people say, I want to attain the state of liberation that I've read about in the yogic literature. So many reasons people come. Will this method help me attain this goal that I have? So what do you tell them when they all have different goals? Well, it's a funny thing, because initially I think it is something which can help all of these things, no matter what it is, no matter what your aim is. And how is that possible, though? Very simple. It simply adjusts within us whatever is required. Wherever there's some imbalance within us, it just balances that. Now, if you're somebody who has a lot of unchecked emotion, perhaps, a lot of emotional imbalance, and you meditate and you find that meditation now is balancing your emotions, you can say, aha, I know what meditation does. It balances your emotions. If you're somebody else, you come for a different reason. You say, I'm not able to concentrate. But now, having meditated, I'm able to focus. So that person makes a different conclusion about meditation. It helps you focus. These two people may now start to argue, right? Meditation does this. No, it does that. But really, it's done one thing. It's created balance. But they understand that balance only in comparison to their previous complaint. They see that complaint has been removed, and they say, aha, it does this. So in the beginning, we find that meditation seems to do many different things, though it only does one thing. Moving forward, then I think people start to have very similar experiences. Now, you know, in the last few days, I've been on this book tour, right? I've been in India. It was released in India first, different publisher. And so I traveled around. I went to 22 cities in India. And then I finished there and I came here. Spent a week with my parents, spent a week with my in-laws, and now I'm doing 31 cities here. And today and yesterday, I've been in the Bay Area for the first time in my life, the West Coast for the first time in my life. And I've gone to so many corporations. And here I find something which for me is unique, because here everyone is talking about stress. It's not so surprising. They're talking about the hectic lifestyle that they have. And they really are, in my estimation, desperate for help and desperate for a solution. People are really suffering. Because, you know, I was speaking to one person today, and he was telling me about how, you know, if he doesn't respond to an email comes out 10 o'clock at night, if he doesn't see it till 6 a.m., he's all of a sudden going to get a reputation that this guy isn't reliable, or you can't count on him, you know? And then all of a sudden, he's no longer as trusted a member of the team as he was before. So there's this constant pressure to be always available, and then that takes a toll. And he was describing to me how it is taking a toll, even medically, on him. And I think many people are in the same position. So yes, our lives are very hectic. Now, there's not much we can do about that in this society. So we have to find a way to create some inner balance in spite of this external circumstances which so many of us are facing. Now here we can create an analogy. We can say that a bird, when it flies on two wings. Both wings are outstretched, right? If it puts one wing down and only one wing is outstretched, then it goes in circles. So in life, we also have two wings. This is we can call it the material wing, the spiritual wing. When they're both stretched outwards, then we soar. But when only one is extended, then there's the possibility, maybe even the probability of going around in circles. And I don't mean only, you know, if we're focused on the external, the material. But I think that's also true if we're exclusively concerned with the spiritual. I think that's equally counterproductive. There has to be some balance. But most of us are preoccupied with the external. So to create balance, it means we have to turn within, address the inner life. But we find difficulty in doing this. You see, this becomes like a bumper sticker kind of thing. Seek within. Turn within, you know. But how to do that? It's not so easy. It's not so easy because, number one, the mind is oriented externally because it's so tied up with the senses. It's woven in with the senses. And anything that, you know, attracts the attention of the senses, all of a sudden, the mind is also attracted there. So there's this natural focus outwards. And another thing is that we're so invested, personally invested in so many things that are happening around us, externally. You know, this stress thing that people are talking about, we have to understand what the cause is of stress. I mean, medically speaking, what is the cause of stress? It's because the adrenaline is being released into the system. And why is that adrenaline release happening? It's because there's a perception that there's an existential threat, right? Threat to life and limb. So you've entered into a fight or flight scenario, and there's an adrenaline release, and that's the cause of the stress. But how often are we actually facing existential threats? I would say it's not so often. But yet we're reacting as if we are. So why is that the case? So I think we have to understand that it's our concept of self that is at the root of this. See, when you think that there is a threat to yourself, you release adrenaline. But when we think of ourselves, we're not only thinking of our bodies. We're not even just thinking about our minds, but we're thinking about what we can call our possessions, ideologies, projects that you're working on, people in your lives, your position in society, your reputation, so many things which we identify with as being myself. So many times in this book tour, I've found that when people introduce themselves to me, they give me the whole CV. Yeah? My name is such and such, I do this, I've been honored like that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This identification with, you know, your accolades and your position and your career and your projects and so many, you know, so many of this paraphernalia, right? It's, you know, endemic. And so when I feel that I am this project that I'm working on, well, can you control the outcome of everything and every one of these? No, there's always going to be some threat, especially to your ideology. You only have to turn on the television and you find your ideology threatened in one way or the other, right? Now, if you view that, this is me, I identify with this, then of course now all of a sudden the body doesn't know. The body is picking up an existential threat. Adrenaline starts pumping. There's stress response. So partly this has to do with readjusting our sense of self, which is, of course, the ego. And that's why so many spiritual systems speak about this ego. And, of course, meditation helps us handle that. It helps us handle that because, you know, we become very sensitive to these issues. Yeah, I was speaking to a friend of mine the other day who'd been meditating for the last year. And I asked her what she'd noticed. I was in New York a couple of days ago, and I asked her what she'd noticed as a result of meditating, and she said one very clear answer. She said, I didn't used to notice when my ego was reacting to things, but now I do notice. And I said, how is that? Okay, so you notice, but how do you feel when you notice? Which is bad. Okay. I mean, it's a very simple thing. When you are, you know, generous, when you're loving, when you're open, when you're accepting, you feel good. And when you're closed and responding, you know, not responding, but reacting with the ego, with jealousy and with the sort of withholding attitude, self-centered attitude, automatically we feel bad. And then finally, when you're able to relate these things together, relate your experience to this attitude, then all of a sudden you realize that the higher my ego goes, the worse I feel. The lower it goes, the better I feel. So it becomes very clear. And now you can, you know, that's like, you know, a GPS. Now you can start to go in the right direction. And then you start to wonder what would happen if I became totally zero. Must be bliss, right? And so that's why the spiritual traditions, they talk about reduction of the ego, and they talk about bliss, because the two things are connected, in fact. But going within, again, this problem of going within, we don't always find it so easy. You know, the problem of the senses, which I mentioned, you know, is there, and a problem of the ego is there. And I think also, just because, let's say you say, okay, I'm really going to not be preoccupied with material concerns. I'm going to go become a monk somewhere, you know. I mean, this happens. I live in India. Sometimes I see these fellows, you know, in the orange robes. You see them wandering around. I also would question, perhaps I'm overstepping my boundaries, but I also would question whether renouncing the world automatically is enough to give you an inner orientation. I'll share two stories, in fact. First thing was something that happened to the co-author of this book, Kamlesh Patel. When he was young, he was interested in meditation. And he was inspired by one great figure in India, Swami Vivekananda, who went wandering around the country, right? And so he went wandering too. He said, I'm going to leave pharmacy school and I'm going to go. So he went down to the Narmada River in Gujarat. And there he found a sort of a troop of sannyasis, these wandering monks in the orange robes. And he found these sannyasis and just hung around sort of at the outskirts. And finally they have a chief there, and the head one called him over. He said, what are you doing here? And he says, I want to join you. And he said, let me talk to you. And he talked to him very seriously. He said, look, don't waste your life. He was shocked. Kamlesh was shocked. He said, what do you mean don't waste my life? He said, I left home when I was a young man. I was married. I had children. I had family. I haven't seen them since then. I don't know what became of my family. I don't know what became of my kids. I've thought of returning home because I also haven't achieved my spiritual goal this way. I've, in fact, gained nothing and lost everything. But I can't go back home now because I can't face everybody after I've abandoned them and not even gained anything. So he said, you're not going to find God like this, so go home. You'll find it. I'm sure you will. But do it a different way. So this shook him up, and he went home. And then a few months later, he also ran across this heartfulness meditation in the 1970s in Gujarat, in Ahmedabad, Gujarat. That's one thing. And then there's another story, too. It's an old story. In Indian mythology, there's a figure called Raja Janak. Now, he's special because he was both a great emperor and also a great yogi, which is a rare combination in these mythological stories, because most of the time the yogis are renunciates who live in the hills or the jungles. So he was both. And there's one story about him where some young novice comes. He wants to learn meditation. He has a guru, and the guru sends him to Raja Janak. He says he'll be able to guide you. So he goes, and his only possessions in life are these pieces of palm leaf where he has his teachings written down. And he goes to Raja Janak, and Janak sees him. And he sees Janak, and he sees that he's an emperor and surrounded by luxury and people fanning him and all sorts of things like this. And he's totally put off. He thinks, this guy is going to help me? I don't think so. Well, in the story, Janak, being a great yogi, somehow catches his thought. And he says, okay, let me teach him a lesson. So all of a sudden, some messenger comes, and he says, there's a great fire in the kingdom. He remains unmoved. Disciple is sitting there. Janak is also sitting there. A few minutes later, he comes back. Messenger comes back. He says, okay, now the palace itself is on fire. Again, Janak just nods. This keeps progressing. Now there's smoke coming in. Heat. And people are around, running around and panicking. And they come and say, this room is on fire. And now this young guy who came with the palm leaves, he's, I'm getting out of here. You know, and he collects up his palm leaves and he's ready to go. And now Janak just sort of snaps his fingers or something and says, enough. And all the flames and all the smoke disappear. And it kind of has a punchline too, because he looks at him and he says, and you thought I was the materialist. You see, because he was so concerned. He was the one who was afraid for his life. He's the one who was keeping his teachings there, scrambling to take them with him, right? So even though you've renounced everything, doesn't mean you've really turned within. Now, in the Raja Yoga tradition, we can say that it's based on this one. It's largely based on one document called the Yoga Sutras. And this consists of mainly of 8 steps, this Yoga Sutras, by the sage Patanjali from, 2,500 years ago or something like that. Now, these 8 steps kind of describe the way that we enter into the state of meditation. But they're unique because the first 4 of them are all about externals. They're all about how you should behave and how to sit for meditation, how to breathe in meditation. But then, number 5 is different. Number 5 is called pratyahara. And pratyahara is all about turning within. So here, this is the bridge. This is first 4 about external things having to do with the body and behavior. And then number 5 comes, and now it's saying turn within. And then after step 5, 6, 7, and 8, that's all, you're already inside. This is all about inner states. 6, 7, and 8 are all about inner states. But this pratyahara, this turning within, is where everyone gets stuck. It's like a bottleneck. Because people say, okay, let me turn within. And they sit and meditate, but then they just have so many thoughts coming. And all the thoughts, of course, are about external things. So they say, I can't meditate. Help. What do I do? And that's the same thing that I faced when I tried those 15 different methods or so. So what to do? So many people get stuck there. Now, their various methods, and they each have a different prescription about how to handle this, how to actually go within. And I would say that some of them are a bit suppressive in nature, in my opinion, in the sense that they say, you know, the mind is your enemy, you know, crush your thoughts, right? Or at least focus on something with such intensity and effort that you won't have any other thoughts. So I think that this is a bit of a repressive method, because now you're just repressing these emotions and thoughts that are coming from inside. And in so doing, you're only going to make them stronger, or they're going to come out in some other way, right?
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And then there are other methods as well. I think, you know, for instance, many of us are familiar with mindfulness these days. And mindfulness, they don't encourage people to suppress anything, but they say it's okay if your mind wanders, just allow it to wander, but observe, try not to react, and just observe this wandering, just observe this wandering and also the sensations and anything else that comes into your field of awareness, just observe that, but don't try to control this thing. So I think that's a very wise approach. You know, and in fact, most of the research that's been done on meditation in the last few decades has focused only on this particular aspect of meditation, where you're allowing thoughts to wander, what we call the mindfulness approach, right? Now, but we also have to remember that this is step number 5 in the system, and that this is something where the intention isn't to simply observe thoughts, but the intention is actually to go beyond this and go inside. So now the question becomes, what helps us? Now, in our approach, in the heartfulness approach, in fact, this burden is not the burden of the seeker, but it's the burden of the trainer. Trainer is responsible for helping you cross this bridge, helping you to go inside. And in fact, I'll give you an example of this, because from today, I have an example, it's a very recent example, around noon today, I did an event in one big company. I signed an NDA, so I can't say which one. But I promise I was there. And I spoke to one gentleman there who said, I just can't meditate because of all the reasons that I described. The incessant thoughts. He's under so much stress for so many reasons that he explained to me. And, you know, and he said, I'm just such a restless guy that I can't even sit, you know, for a minute. So meditation, just forget it. But we did a meditation. He meditated along with me. Now, in these 8 steps that I'm mentioning over and over again of the Yoga Sutras, it's number 5 is pratyahara, it's turning within. Now let's skip number 6, number 7, number 8. Let's get to number 8. That's called samadhi. Okay. Samadhi is a state where you're just totally absorbed within. Totally absorbed, you know, you can say in the source. But now in this samadhi state, you can say, actually the samadhi has been so highly extolled throughout history. You know, people say, oh, it's an unattainable thing. This deep level of absorption in meditation. But this gentleman today, who could never meditate, in 15-minute meditation, well, he was in samadhi at the end of that meditation. He was absolutely absorbed within himself. So we see this isn't such a crazy thing which is unattainable after all. You just need to, well, he found something that worked for him, you know? And why? How does that happen? Here in this system, we have something called yogic transmission. The Sanskrit word for it too, it's called pranahuti. Pranahuti is something where we can say that the spiritual aspect of yoga that you're trying to reunite with your source. Because yoga comes from a word that means that which unites. So what is this union? The individual with the absolute, individual with the universal, the person with the source of existence. And that's something you have to find within. That's not something you seek for externally. Again, our orientation being so externalized, our approach to this tends to also be externalized, and therefore our imaginations go to work, and we imagine God sitting in heaven and all sorts of things outside ourselves. But when you turn this mind around and you go inside, then you no longer have such projections anymore. And you can experience something within. You come into contact with the source, because when you touch something hot, you feel hot. And you touch something cold, you feel cold. If you come into contact with the source of your existence, well, you start to imbibe its qualities as well. You start to become so balanced inside. You start to experience that peace. So many things start happening. And in fact, we can't even say it has any qualities when we're talking about the source. There was somebody once asked one of the guides in our lineage, please, what is God? Tell me, what is God? And he said, remove all adjectives, was his answer. Remove all adjectives. So we cannot say that what we're seeking for even has any qualities. Yet, when we come into contact with it, it produces certain qualities within us. And so there we go, and we experience those. Now, somebody who has just dissolved themselves, absolutely dissolved themselves in the universal, somehow becomes able to invoke that on our behalf, to allow us to experience it in some mysterious way. This is what was referred to as yogic transmission. References exist to this. This isn't something new, just cooked up. So you see it. You see it. Even in Buddhism, there's some references to it. You see it in Yoga Vashishta, this ancient yogic text. You find reference to it in the Kena Upanishad also. It's there, hinted at here and there. But so far, it has remained rather esoteric, rather closed, where people who are imparting training through Panahuti, through yogic transmission, don't tend to publicize it and just keep it to some close disciples. We see this also in the Sufi tradition, also there. The heartfulness approach, I think its uniqueness is its openness. It says, okay, we throw open the gates, we throw out this esoteric attitude to spirituality. For one and all, anyone who wants can come and try. No fee, no cost, nothing. You like it, you come. That's it. So this yogic transmission is available to all. And it is something which creates experience in us, I would say. Because, you know, you can say that the air surrounds us at all times, but you don't feel it until there's a breeze. The fan comes on, now you feel it. Similarly, people believe, religious people will believe, they'll say that God is omnipresent or divinity is omnipresent. But who actually experiences that? It remains only in the realm of belief. And then therefore, because you don't experience it, people also disbelieve. They say, why should I believe if I don't experience it? It's a valid point. I would suggest you don't just believe something, right? So in the same way, I would say that transmission is that breeze where all of a sudden you experience something. And that experience itself is what attracts the mind to go within. It won't go there by force. It has to be attracted, right? Just like the fragrance of your mother's cooking attracts you to the kitchen, right? So something has to attract the mind. And when you feel something inside, the mind naturally gets absorbed inside. You get absorbed within because of that experience attracting you, not because of anything else, not because you're forcing your mind into a state of concentration. No, it doesn't work that way. I had a wonderful experience lately in India. I went and met an order of monks and, you know, released this book there in their premises. And I explained to them, they wanted to know what is the uniqueness of this method. I explained about yogic transmission. And then the guy, the head monk, he threw down a challenge too. He said, it reminded me of one of these old kung fu movies, because he says, let's see what tricks your master has taught you, you know. So he wanted me to conduct meditation. And afterwards, he was been meditating his whole life. I mean, he knew meditation in and out. He knew much better than I'll ever know all the yogic texts and shastras and everything like that. I don't know the stuff. He really knows it. But experience is greater than knowledge. And he had an experience. And he was like with tears in his eyes afterwards. And he embraced me because he said, this I've never experienced. So that was a moving moment, I think. It was moving for me to see someone experience something like that. And so this is about the role of the trainer. Of course, the trainer isn't some great yogi who's dissolved himself in the source, but such a person can prepare any average Joe from the street. Just pull them off the street and prepare them. Okay, now you can also impart transmission, see? So that's how we're able to have so many trainers, 10,000 trainers worldwide, in about 150 countries or so. That's how this works. And of course, there's other things too, because you have to understand that transformation is something, as I said earlier, books didn't help me. Reading didn't help me. And this monk story, remember I told you about this monk who goes and sees Raja Janak, you know, when he's scrambling to pick up his teachings on the palm leaves. Janak was trying to tell him something about those teachings also. See, your knowledge that you get from somebody isn't enough to transform you. This is a fact of spirituality. It won't ever help you because, you know, can I say, there's an old story from... this old story where someone's doing a lot of wrong things and someone comes and tries to get him to change his ways and he says, look, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. You don't have to tell me that. But knowing what's right, I'm unable to live by it, and knowing what's wrong, I'm unable to avoid it. So what do I do? And a lot of us are like that because we have these tendencies within us which are propelling us. And though you know I want to go this way, I want to change myself like that, I've read this book, I want to be like this, is somehow not enough because the conscious mind is working, but then the subconscious tendencies seem to be stronger somehow and they're driving us, you know? So what do we do? So you need a method or something that acts on the subconscious, not just on the conscious mind, but on the subconscious mind, and removes these obstacles from within so that change naturally happens. And when it happens, it comes from within. In a natural way, so you don't even notice that you've changed, because it happens without your knowledge. See, other people notice, your spouse notices. Always, but you won't notice. So this is, especially in the yoga tradition, this is called samskara, these tendencies inside, which are the result of our emotional memory, actually, because when we have so many interactions, create reactions within ourselves, that emotion gets deposited. We forget about it, but it's there. But next time something triggers you, triggers that emotion again, that emotion comes out again and propels you to act in a particular way, to think in a particular way. And now you react, now you've created a blueprint for future reactions, for future thoughts, for future emotions. And the more this takes place, sort of the riverbed gets deeper, you can say, you know. And when that happens, now you start creating tendencies. You get the character starts being developed in a very unique or very particular way, you know. So there we go. But it's also possible to remove these, what we call these samskaras, this emotional content which is there sitting in our subconscious, which drives us so much of the time. So that's another yogic technique, which is a part of this heartfulness approach. And with it, we really have the possibility of transforming ourselves. We have the possibility of changing ourselves. And, you know, ultimately, I would say that, you know, this isn't about knowledge, as I said. This is about experience. Such things have to be experienced. Even yogic transmission, I have been speaking about it, but I would not ask you to accept that. This is something you can meditate without it and meditate along with it. See the difference for yourself. Make your own conclusions. Make your own conclusions. This is not a belief to be imposed or to be accepted, either way. Try things. Take a scientific approach to the spiritual business and really conclude yourself, because in spirituality, truth can't be known through another person. It has to be experienced for yourself, or it's not valid. You know? And in this spiritual experiment, well, you're the one who's performing the experiment, you're the subject of the experiment, and you're also the result of that experiment. You know? And this is a journey of discovery. And this is a journey which is filled with joy and wonder because of that constant discovery on this sort of endless path. So that's what heartfulness is all about. Now, I would like to give a demonstration of this kind of meditation we practice. And so I'll briefly explain how we meditate. And then we'll take maybe 15 minutes and meditate. Watch out, the coffee. Sound good? People want to meditate? Okay. So first, let me just give you the gist of it. Here, remember what I said, that meditation is here we do not concentrate. Okay? Remove that idea from your mind. But we have an object of meditation nonetheless, and that object of meditation is presence of light in the heart. Okay, so you don't believe it, fine. But don't take it as a belief. Take it as a hypothesis, please. Hypothesis requires this much of an open mind. Okay. Belief requires too much. Right? Hypothesis and belief, what's the difference? Hypothesis requires verification. Belief doesn't require. Maybe it requires verification, but the person with the belief doesn't want any verification. Right? So take it as a hypothesis instead. Let's test this. And so how do we go about this process? Is it to visualize light in the heart? No. One definition which I like of this light is light without luminosity. I very much enjoy this definition, not just because it's confusing, but it is confusing. Because can you imagine light without luminosity? No, you can't imagine that. And that's the point. It's an instruction, not a description. It's telling you, don't try to imagine it. Don't try to visualize it. Because you will. It's a visual thing. Light is a visual thing. So as soon as someone talks about light, you'll try to visualize it. So it's saying, don't do that. So what do we do instead? How do we handle this notion? Well, it's something that you feel. That's what it is. This is a matter of feeling, not of seeing or thinking. Matter of feeling. And that's why we are meditating on the heart. Because the heart is where you feel things. Let's say, and you say, I love you. You don't say, I love you. You say, I love you, like this. I love you. No. Here. So this is where we feel things. So meditation is about feeling. And don't worry, oh, what am I going to feel? How am I going to feel this? Can't manufacture such feelings. So don't even try. Instead, you just wait. Meditation is really a state of waiting, a state of being receptive, a state of being open, without expectation, and just seeing whatever it is that you're going to feel, whatever it is that you may or may not experience. Just see. So we have to put our attention in this realm of feeling. We have to go into this realm of feeling and put your attention in a very gentle way in your heart, your chest area, you can say, and just see what happens. That's it. Waiting is very potent. It's like a vacuum. It's like a vacuum that attracts something too. So that's what we do. And in terms of the mind, what do you do with your thoughts? It's okay. The mind has a purpose. It produces thoughts. So don't worry. It will produce thoughts. But you don't have to just say, great, now let me think about all of these things. Don't go overboard. Entertain them with so much passion and enthusiasm. That that much is within our control. But you don't have to fight them and say, no, I don't want to think this, or no, that thought is a terrible thought. I don't, what's happening? Just allow it to be there. And remembering that that can happen at the same time as you're meditating here with feeling. This feeling and thinking, they can happen simultaneously. It's not so crazy. We have had emotions and thoughts at the same time before in our lives. So you can see how this works. So that's what we do. When I say, please start meditation, that's just very gently, just see what happens. And before we meditate, I'll just walk you through a very brief relaxation process. Because when the body's relaxed, somehow it's all easier for the mind to meditate.
Hello? Uh-huh. Okay, we have time for questions now, and let me come around with the microphone so we'll be recorded. Any questions?
How often would you say we should engage in this kind of activity?
Meditation.
Yeah, meditation. Hmm. Would you recommend?
Well, ideally, I would say it's a daily practice. But if you don't, in the book, in the Heartfulness Way, it's said not to make this a discipline. You make it a discipline means you're using your willpower. Use your willpower. Meditation is all about attitude. It's all about feeling, attitude. So if you're doing it as a discipline, with that attitude, if you're doing it with willpower, it's akin to sitting with a loved one and saying, I'm using all of my willpower to sit next to you. See, I mean, that's not what you would say to a loved one. They would want you to want to be there with them, right? So this doesn't work if inwardly we're resisting it. We're saying, I'm going to meditate, but I don't want to meditate. Forget about meditation. It won't happen, even if your eyes are closed. So, if you don't feel like it, then don't do it, but otherwise do it.
In the heartfulness way, as opposed to mindfulness or any other type of meditation, are you always focusing on the heart? That's one part of the question. The second part is, how do you distinguish, or how do you come to terms with the idea that you've tried 15 or 16 different meditation practices that did nothing for you, and yet the heartfulness way, that approach on your first experience, it did something for you. Hmm. So it's a two-part.
Okay, so not just meditating, when we're asking if we should focus on the heart. Focus, I would say, rest on the heart. Rest. Meditation is, first of all, an effortless thing. In this book, you can't see it here, but there's a chapter 2, there's a quadrant, right? You can't, if you can see this, there's a quadrant here, right? Which clearly differentiates. You see, you have a spectrum. On one end there's effort, the other end is effortless. That's one. Then the other axis, is one end is unfocused, the other end is focused. Right. So when you combine these different states together, you get different results. So if you combine effort and focus, that's concentration. You're using effort in order to focus. So you're concentrating. But if you combine effortlessness along with focus, then that's meditation. So this is an important thing. It has to be effortless. It has to be natural. And so I may be perhaps focusing myself on the wrong part of your question, because you're more interested in the heart. And I would say that the heart isn't just an object of meditation, but it's something which leads us through our lives when we become sensitive to the heart. Because, you know, these lives that we're living, I think, are often directed towards very transitory or illusory values. right? But I think that the heart also knows what the essential things are, and the more that we can connect with the heart, the more we'll live in such a way that we live according to universal values, which are intrinsic to the heart. Values like, you know, acceptance and empathy and love and understanding, things like that, which define us as human beings, in fact. There we have to connect to the heart in order to do that. So the heart becomes a guide, and the more we connect with it, the more we're able to do that, and the more we're able to discriminate also in an intuitive way between, yes, this is something I should do, no, that's something I shouldn't do. You know, so that really this is a heart-centered approach to living, I would say. And second part, I'm not sure I understood completely.
In your personal experience, in that you were drawn to Taoism, Buddhism, and
I still am,
and meditation since you were a young child. But despite all the reading and despite your many attempts to practice a variety of different meditations, none of them had any effect on you. But when you first tried the heartfulness way, when you met the guy in Ohio, something happened to you. Mm. So can you define what took place? What was present for you? Is it the heart? Was it the approach of heart as opposed to anything else that you had experienced prior to that?
So, okay, thank you for clarifying that. I can say that it wasn't anything about an ideology that appealed to me. In fact, this ideology did not appeal to me. Very clearly did not appeal to me. So this isn't about I agree with this philosophy and I don't agree with that philosophy and therefore I do it. Nothing like that. Only thing is that when I meditated, I felt I'm home. When I meditated, I felt, in a very intuitive way, this is what I was looking for. I can't define what it is or even what I was looking for, but this feeling, this is something, now I can relax. You know, I've come home. It was that kind of feeling. I meditated in other ways where instead the feeling I got was this heaviness inside or this feeling of angst or discomfort or sometimes doubt, lots of doubt about what am I doing kind of thing. So the feeling is what made me feel comfortable enough to continue. And then in terms of the philosophy, it's not so important, I think.
Were you able to incorporate anything from what, there are all the 15 or whatever number of ways that didn't work for you? Were you able to go back to it at any time and go, get this?
Yeah,
or that,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, this isn't like a black and white thing where I tried 15 useless things and then one great thing. I know it's not quite like that, you know, because there's always something of value there. I think what it's helped me to do, if I go back, let's say, and read some of these things that I read before, I have greater understanding of them now. You know, because I've experienced something, and that experience resonates with what's written there. So I say, that's what they were talking about. Kind of thing, you know. In the same way, we never recommend that, you know, anyone is, as a spiritual approach, if you you don't have to approach this as a spiritual approach. You can use it as a simple stress management tool or whatever. But if you do approach it as a spiritual approach, you use it as that kind of approach, then the recommendation is not that you abandon whatever you're already doing either. Recommendation is not that you leave your religious tradition or background. It's nothing like that. This is just an experiential method that can help you, you know, help you actually understand the truth of your religion. It'll help you appreciate your religion more. It'll help you appreciate whatever it is that you're already doing more, because this experience will help you, give you new understanding, new insight. And you say, okay, this is what they were talking about. On the surface, many traditions can be speaking different languages, or they look like they are. But if you experience something, you say, okay, they all have the same essence. They all have the same essence, but you have to actually experience that essence to be able to recognize that essence in other traditions. You have to be able to experience your own essence in order to recognize that everybody else has the same essence as you. So it's this is kind of thing, I would say.
Okay, I think we'll take the rest of the questions after the formal program. I'm Bill Grant, co-chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum of the Commonwealth Club. We thank Joshua Pollack for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 115 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.